So, welcome to A Tale of Two Galilee, or Galilean versus Galilean versus Galilean. So, who hasn't heard of Galileo Galilei? None of you? Good. Now, who has heard of his dad, Vincenzo? Well, I'm not too surprised, because unless you're a lutenist or interested in 17th century music theory, you wouldn't have. I borrowed the two titles thing from Rocky and Bullwinkle, mainly for my own amusement, but it really does take two titles to name this talk. As far as I know, Galileo and his dad, the first two Galileans, were not at odds personally. You could even say that they worked together to drive the final nails into the coffin of an old world view. And that's where they come into conflict with the third Galilean, the man from Galilee, even though they themselves had nothing against Jesus, as far as I know. The old world view that I'm thinking of is the harmony of the spheres, which associated the seven moving celestial objects with the seven named notes of music. The details of how the interrelations of Sun, Moon, Mars, Mercury, Venus, Saturn, and Jupiter related to A through G don't matter, which is convenient for me to say, because over the thousands of years since someone thought there was a harmony of the spheres, they've undoubtedly been represented and interpreted in hundreds of thousands of ways. What matters for this talk is to show the long-time human awareness and fascination with the visible yet intangible orbs of astronomical objects, entwined with human awareness and fascination with the audible and also intangible notes of music. Both orbs and notes are characterized by cyclical movement occurring within a perceptual space that is innately common to all humans of all times. Moreover, what's perceived are not just detected motions, positions, and distances, but feelings of longing, recognition, and fulfillment related to a universal sense of beauty. I am more orally than visually oriented, but occasionally the moon does catch my eyes and I have to stop and say, wow. But it's not enough of a wow to hold my attention for more than a minute or so, let alone for me to tune in every night to track the changes. But it is enough to get a sense of how the beauty of the moon against the backdrop of the stars could attract and hold someone else's attention and imagination. If I hear the sound of a clarinet, on the other hand, I can immediately tune in to the quality of the note being played and follow the trajectory of its melody while anticipating its resolution. Granted, I would not have the patience to wait 28 days for a melody to resolve, but the point I'd like to make is that both the moon and the note that holds my attention are intangible, yet perceivable, and thus real entities having motion within a structural framework that for some mysterious reason human beings find compelling. It's human nature to want to understand things. We have a desire to know. If I'm attracted to a person, I want to know them. If I like music or astronomy, I want to know more about the subject. The problem with understanding Ned or B-flat or the moon is that they only exist as Ned or B-flat or the moon at a distance, and then only in relation to others having the same nature. Ned among other human beings, B-flat among other notes, and the moon appearing amongst the stars while also relative to the sun disappearing. Measuring the distances between planets and notes and defining the geometry of these qualitative spaces was only a foundation. The real mystery was movement within those spaces. Geometry as a basis from which to ponder cyclically ordered movement is what the studies of astronomy and music were all about up until the Reformation era. Measuring the distance and defining the geometry of the rationalizing and feeling components of the inner person as a basis from which to consider movements of the spirit were the domains of philosophy and religion back then. In our times, those became the domains of neuroscience and psychology. Galileo impacted celestial geometry. Vincenzo impacted musical geometry. And the Reformation era, in which both men from the family Galilee lived, impacted the geometry of the inner person, which Jesus of Galilee had previously defined by way of the cross. Don't let the word geometry intimidate you. We're not going to start doing sines and cosines or go off on tangents of various modern geometries. By geometry, I only mean the shape and structure of things, their positions, and their relation to each other within the ordinary everyday space we see, hear, and move through. We see things in a continuum of up, down, left, right, and front, back. We also see them as near or far, which adds a flavor of time to our visual geometry. Close your eyes, and you also hear things with the same positioning in space. You don't just hear a sound without also hearing it positionally. A twig snaps, and you intuitively know where to look if you want to see what made it snap. You can also reach your objects without looking at them. Walk into a dark but familiar room, and you can find your way to a lamp by the interaction of memory with your positional and kinetic senses, all of which share the same spatial geometry with oneself as the point of origin. And because all of the senses share the same spatial and temporal geometry, they need to function as one harmonic whole. If we see a dog bark in front of us, but hear its bark way over to the left, where there ain't no dog, or we see an apple in one place, but reach for it somewhere else, we call that a disorder. Memory of experienced movement is what makes distances fathomable. I only need to put out a hand to reach this apple. I had to walk a long time to get to that apple tree. And memory also lends feelings to what is sensed. Those bees sound aggressive. Bees live in that apple tree. But it was an enjoyable morning's walk until that dog chased me. Music and astronomy exist in oral and visual spaces that are removed from the physicality of earthly experience, yet share the same sense of dimensionality. We cannot walk to the moon or Venus, or from an A to an E, let alone reach out and touch them. But we do have a sense that the moon is closer to us than Venus, and that it moves faster. Likewise, but only sort of likewise, we have a sense of distance and movement amongst musical notes, with one of them as a stable base, much like the earth is our stable base when looking up at the heavens. I want to keep focused on the Hellenic culture and the Christian culture that grew out of it, but I should also point out that every ancient civilization developed disciplines of music and geometry with a sense of their interrelatedness. I remember reading in China's history, for example, that the official measure of the interval of a fifth had been changed to align with the latest astronomical measurements. A dynasty's official standard could also be changed at the whim of the emperor. Though it's not like either perceptual or astronomical or musical measures had the last word over politics. That'll be important later on in the retreat, so keep that little tidbit tucked away somewhere. Going back to the idea of intangible spaces sharing a similar dimensionality with tangible space, we find are the plausible beginnings of abstract thought. Since we can't walk to the moon or touch an A, the only way to think about them, if we want to understand them, are as points without dimension or mass. In the modern age, we can't help but think of planets as physical objects of enormous size, but to ancient minds, they were just luminous points in the night sky. Obviously, the moon appears to be larger than Venus. But since the ancients were only concerned with the position and movements of the various points, The size difference was no more than the difference in size of a point drawn with a sharp pencil or a Sharpie. The modern mind thinks in terms of quantities of mass and distance because our understanding of orbs and their motion is in terms of the gravitational force between them, the product of their masses in proportion to the distance squared. I'm going to skip past the ancient mind of early civilization and go way, way back to the primitive mind. Whatever the Egyptians or Peruvians or Babylonians or Greeks were doing with their geometries and astronomies came out of an evolving capacity for abstract, though logical, thought. On Earth, length, height, and distance are things that gave off a sense of quantity when they could be likened to a number of footsteps, or the stacking of hands, or the number of times the sun rose and set between full moons. As for the sun, moon, and stars themselves, they were just points in the sky. They weren't reachable objects whose distance could be paced off or whose height could be measured in terms of hands, let alone be reached by in a number of countable days. And yet, these objects had position and motion. More than that, the sun and moon have a reliable and cyclical motion that could be used to measure things that were too many paces to count. A day's journey rather than 28,752 steps. The geometric concept of a point having position, but neither mass nor dimension, was hardly a breakthrough. The geometric conception of a point having position, but neither mass nor dimension, was hardly a breakthrough in thought when it was a living reality to the primitive mind. A luminous point in the sky was real in the sense of perceived existence, and yet not real in the sense of tangibility. And some of them showed signs of life. They moved and changed in color and intensity, some faster or in different ways than others, but always in relation to each other, against a backdrop of fixed points, and will be held in memory. All of the rudiments of geometry were right up there in the sky as an integral part of daily experience. Nowadays, we learn from TV. 50,000 years ago, the night sky was TV, and with that way of thinking, the sounds of nature were radio. The discovery of primitive flutes, dating back to about the same time frame of 50,000 years, shows that human beings were beginning to tune in to the concepts of these pre-existent media. There's no way to know when we began visually tuning in to the inherent order exhibited by particular luminosities in the sky above, but early flutes give us an idea of when we began orally tuning into the inherent order of particular tonal relationships. In both cases, we were tuning in to the intangible yet perceptible entities that exhibited structural and hierarchical properties, properties distinguishable by their heightened quality. What would later be called perfect intervals are nothing more than what human beings perceived to be the highest qualitative state of those intervals. Think of the sun being at its highest position in the sky at the summer solstice. The solstice evoked feelings in primitive human beings long before they had any type of rational understanding of it. They had a sense of zenithal quality on that day that still exists for a lot of people, whether or not they know anything about angles of inclination, axial tilt, or whatnot. But this sense of a summer solstice only exists in relation to a winter solstice. And between the solstices are high and low points of other luminosities. You find a similar thing with the intervals of music. The summer solstice is felt to be the furthest distance from the winter solstice while having an identical quality. This is similar to how an octave above a given note is perceived as being the furthest away from it while radiating a unifying quality. Between the span of an octave, which are the low and high points of a mode or scale, we find the other intervals of music, each of which had their own qualitative peaks, such as the fifth or a pure major third. Nobody knows the exact moment of the solstice without instrumental measurements, just like nobody knows the exact measure of any musical interval without an instrument like the early monochord or the modern oscilloscope. But if you're listening to a piano tuner zeroing in on an octave or fifth, you don't need anything other than your ear to tell you when those intervals are perfect. You feel it with an inner sense before the oscilloscope confirms it. This innate, intuitive, and inner knowledge had to have pre-existed and guided the creation and development of musical instruments, since each and every culture's musical intervals converge on the same standards. And don't forget that the ear was the only available gauge until electronics came along. With a 50,000-year-old mindset, what you'll find are some people tuning in to the visual order above, and some tuning in to the oral order within. Most of the others couldn't care less, and were doing other things like surviving and procreating. But the visual geeks and oral nerds would have been sharing their observations and ruminations at Cavecon BC's, which would have furthered a sense of interrelatedness. Ideas start with hunches. Hunches that are doodled and sketched before they're formally expressed. There's no way to know what primitive stargazers might have traced in the dirt while pondering luminescences, but I can't imagine it being anything other than points connected by lines and arcs, sketches that would eventually lead to the mathematical representations we find much later in the archaeological record. We also have no idea of what the primitive vocalizations which became music sounded like, but we do have the artifacts of early flutes with tone holes. Blowing in the flute with all the holes opened produces a fundamental tone. Close a tone hole and you hear another tone a distance away from the fundamental. What probably started with a hollow bone, followed by a bone with a single tone hole, and then multiple holes, could not have been a random arrangement. If it were just personal taste, instruments from Peru to Germany to China would not have converged in the same exact measures of perfect fourths, fifths, and octaves, each with the same structural function and relationships. Musical instruments were not designed to introduce something new. They came about to reinforce what was already known and felt through vocalizations. But forget about the sound for a moment. If we just look at the flute, what we see is a linear arrangement of tone holes proportional to the length of the hole. These holes eventually found their rightful locations when the physical distance separating the holes matched the perceived distance separating the notes. So in the visual layout of a flute, we can see a concrete and linear representation of the abstract points which make up the structure of a musical octave. Points and lines, the most basic elements of what would become the abstractions of geometry, at the fingertips and on the lips of human beings some 47,000 years before Euclid wrote his book on geometry. It seems only natural, then, that music and astronomy would be integrated as a single study, since they shared the same abstract notions of points, lines, and proportional relationships. Geometry could account for the structural elements and forms of astronomy and music, but not the impetus or the trajectories of movement within those frameworks. The study of movement became the study of harmony, with the two interrelated branches of music and astronomy. What further distinguished the study of harmony, however, was that it was as much qualitative as it was quantitative. Because we can't see notes, but can recognize a third as a third or a fifth as a fifth, within slight deviations from what we feel to be the perfect state, of a visceral satisfaction with the perceived beauty of their relationships, was and remains the ultimate judge of what constitutes the measure or truth of any interval. An interval's peak beauty corresponds to the truth of its perfect or pure measure. What that means is that we assess musical space by the quality of its intervals. If we're exploring the space of a minor mode, the third will be 6 over 5, in contrast to the space of a major mode, where the third will be 5 over 4. Knowing these numbers means about as much to the listener as knowing that a marathon is 26.2 miles means to a couch potato. But just the conceptions of major and minor mean a lot. Tell someone that the first third of a race will be uphill and bright sunshine, and you've instilled a preconception of the minor mode with its anticipated huffy, puffy, and sweaty first third. The mathematical measure of pure minor or major third does not change any more than the markers do in the marathon. Every mode or race has a third whose character helps define the modal space you're exploring in the creative process or running in the course of a race. Which third you'll find within a mode is what makes it either major or minor. When we intone a melody, we're basically creating the positions of the notes orbiting the fundamental tone in order to create the musical space of the mode we're singing in. We're not so much creating musical space as we are actualizing it according to a fixed and innate standards of pure and perfect intervals within the continuum of acoustic space. Astronomy, on the other hand, is an entirely visual and pre-existing fixed system. We can try measuring the positions and movement within the system, but we can't change anything. We neither create nor actualize it. We may derive feelings of beauty from the colors of a sunset or the brilliance of a silvery moon, but those fleeting aesthetics pale to the sense of awe we get while pondering the fixity of the system as a whole and the constancy of the movements that herald changing seasons, cycles of migrations, and cycles of menstruation. It's too easy to go off in tangents here, so I need to get back to the family Galilee with a very distinct focus. I want to put aside the obvious sun-centered versus earth-centered thing. The bottom line there is that we learned the true nature of planets, their motions, their relations to each other, and the underlying forces that bind and affect them. For thousands of years, we were able to fabricate mathematics that made an Earth-based system viable, but it was clumsy and limited because it was not based on a true depiction of reality. The telescope helped reveal the true nature of celestial objects, and revealed truth is always a good thing. If you have any doubts, just remember that we might not have had Velcro or Tang if Galileo's observations had not led to the space program. My interest, though, is far more subtle. When Galileo peered through his telescope, what he saw were no longer abstract luminous points. He saw hunks of matter analogous to the balls used in his experiments with falling objects and worked with ballistics. The former abstract points of celestial systems were treated as ordinary objects not only because the extended visual sense showed spheres of matter, but also because Galileo likened the celestial interactions to his experimental work with material objects. It's natural to use a lesser likeness to grasp an understanding of the greater image. But the understanding of Galileo's lesser model of earthbound spheres was assumed to be the whole story and was projected onto the greater image of the celestial spheres. It's little wonder, then, that this reduction of the wonders that had been pondered with awe for hundreds of centuries caused such a stir. Galileo's work, of course, was not the last word, but merely a preface leading to discoveries that are still unfolding. And like any advertising campaign, it only told the part of the story that it wanted to sell consumers on. I'm not accusing Galileo of false advertising, but the likeness he was selling didn't really satisfy his customers because it was devoid of feelings, contrary to intuitions, and made a farce of things once held sacred. On an intellectual level, his work altered the worldview from an Earth to a sun-centered universe. But on a more subliminal level, his worldview gave reason to doubt one's senses and question whether the abstractions of mind or raw perceptions were more trustworthy. It ended up shifting the arbiter of truth from our perceptions and inner sensibilities to the dictates of instrumental measurements, along with their supporting mathematical and mental abstractions. Thousands of years before Galileo's use of the visual instrument, we find humans exploring the world of sound with oral instruments. Ordinary sounds are situated and make sense within the same dimensional space as visual objects because we recognize their connection to physical objects, beings, and natural occurrences like wind or thunder. Musical sounds, however, exist in a space beyond physicality. Musical sounds may emanate from the physical, birds singing or wind whistling or someone thumping on logs, but the tones or notes they produce are oral objects as distant from our everyday world as the stars and planets. We can't see notes, but we can hear and feel them from pressure waves bearing the naturally occurring order of harmonic sound. We may be blind as bats when it comes to musical space, but like our creepy mammalian cousins, we can sound out the terrain of musical space to pick out individual notes along with their trajectories of movements. The human voice and ear are akin to a bat's sonar when it comes to musical space. While they're hunting, bats need to know about trees and boulders and other fixed obstacles as much as they do about the insects they chase and their trajectories. And other bats, so they don't crash into each other. Likewise, in order to perceive a melody, we need to be aware of structural elements such as key and time signatures, modes, dominants and tonics, and all the steps between in order to assess the character of a note and see where it's headed. If our musical sonar did not pre-exist music and language, which, by the way, only exists within musical space, neither would have been able to develop in the course of human history. With the crafting of musical instruments, we can see human beings headed toward a rational understanding of musical space. At first, it was intuitive, but once Pythagoras was able to associate intervals with numbers, we had a way to measure musical space similar to how the ancients were able to measure astronomical space. With his monochord, Pythagoras was able to define the perceived perfection of an octave as being twice the note below it, a fifth as 1.5 times, and a fourth as 1.3 times the note below. Human beings were already aware of and intuitively building upon these perfect intervals. But with a precise mathematical measure, they were able to map out musical structure in terms of tetrachords that could be assembled into modes, as well as begin engineering more accurate instruments. The heightened quality of a perfect fifth and its drive toward a home base also led Pythagoras to theorize the existence of 12 notes, each a fifth above the other, until they returned to the original note. This is what's known as the circle of fifths, which is at the heart of Western music's theory and practice. Only Western music made the circle of fifths its guiding principle. It became our worldview of musical space. The flaw in this musical worldview is that it falls short of perceived reality. What we perceive in musical relationships is a hierarchical order that stems from our ability to discern pure and perfect intervals. What's put forth in Pythagoras' theory is an order of absolute equality. Each note within his proposed 12-tone systems would need to be exactly the same distance from all the others. The problem with the theory is that 12 successive perfect fifths do not return to the original note. In reality, it's a spiral of fifths and not a circle. What the spiral ends up on is a note noticeably sharper than where it began. Like sliding into the batter's circle rather than home plate, it's not a home run. In order to make the theoretical circle work, you have to shave a little off each fifth to squish them together. This is what's called equal temperament. It's obvious that it works as a musical system because of its predominance in musical practice the world over. Squished intervals, however, are not fully satisfying, which is why there was, in very small circles that continues to be, heated argument for and against equal temperament. Fun as it may be for me to join in, all I want to say for now is that equal temperament only exists in practice because it's enforced by instruments with fixed intonation, like keyboards, guitars, and good old Vinny's axe, the lute. The natural tendency of any singer or instrumentalist is towards pure and perfect intervals, because somewhere deep down inside of us, those are what we yearn for. There's enough leeway in the wind player's embouchure to adjust an interval from its tempered to its true measure. For unfretted strings, it's just a matter of where the finger is placed. A keyboard or guitar player, however, is stuck with tempered intervals. If either instrument is part of an ensemble, everyone will subconsciously use that instrument as its reference. And we very consciously dull the student's innate sensitivity to and tendency toward perfect intervals when we use the piano or guitar as a pedagogical tool. What I want to draw attention to is the difference in the way Galileo and his dad used instruments. Galileo used the telescope to gain a new perspective for our visual sense. If you're way up high in a plane, what you'll see are forests and deserts. You can't feel intrinsic elements of those ecosystems, like trees or cacti, unless you've previously had the perspective of being on the ground. At a lower altitude, or with high-powered binoculars, you'd be able to see plant and animal life. But without memory of prior sensate experience, you'd still be an outside observer, unable to smell, touch, hear, and get a feel for forest or desert. Unless you were born in an airplane and never left your aluminum cocoon, you will have some sort of experience related to an ecosystem of plants and animals, along with their interactions and interdependencies, even if it's just from a small park within a concrete jungle. The telescope provided Galileo with a view into the internals of celestial systems. Unfortunately, the only experiential reference he could bring to the minutiae of planets, moons, and stars were the balls used in his experiments with objects in motion. It's little wonder, then, that the feel of the world view growing out of his observations was mechanical rather than animate. I'm not saying that the planets are alive or that God dwells in them, only that they exist in God's love, just like everything else, and especially us. The telescope enabled us to see luminescences as objects, but the only feel the instrument brought to those objects was the feel of lifeless matter subjugated to the then-known laws of mechanics. At least that's how it would appear to the average person. The scientifically inclined and academics, on the other hand, had something more to go on. They had a feel for the mathematical symbols that flavored and supported the visual observations. For them, mathematics represented the truth. Earth-centered astronomy had long had a mathematic by which he could account for celestial positions and movements and make predictions. It may have been complicated and convoluted, but if it hadn't worked reasonably well, it would not have been around for thousands of years. The math coming out of Galileo's observations not only worked better, but the simplicity and elegance of the mathematics accompanying the new astronomy had a beauty in and of itself that the old astronomy's math lacked. In other words, the mental abstractions of the new astronomy had both greater truth and greater beauty. It's very difficult to put this into words. But what I see happening back then is a divergence of them folks finding love in the truth and beauty from their immediacy, from them other folks finding love in the truth and beauty of abstraction. Both of them still had an underlying yearning for absolute truth and zenithal beauty, a yearning that was driven by love. But one side placed their trust in what's intelligible, and the other in what's intuited. The first subjugates the heart to the intellect. The latter is a slave to the heart. Maybe what I'm saying has been borne out by history, maybe not. You can think about it and decide for yourselves. All I want to propose is that there's an underlying dance of truth, beauty, and love, regardless of one's perspective. At their extremes, one perspective grew to exclude, or at the very least to really, really obscure anything above and beyond nature. This is the perspective that ultimately seeks truth in a cold, rationalizing mind. The other was trying not to be swept away by the current of intellectualization, by clinging to faith as it waited for a rescue. For them, truth was based in the heart. Neither type of person abandoned the perichoresis of truth, beauty, and love. But for one, the mind led the dance. For the other, the heart. At least as far as regard for the supernatural is concerned. Meanwhile, back on Earth, music accompanied both dances. So we need to note that it's also at this point in history that music was demoted from being a branch of mathematics in university studies to being just a form of art. The objective measures of musical intervals more or less became the exclusive domain of engineers, while practitioners of music focused more or less exclusively on its subjective aspects. And this brings us to Vincenzo. Unlike a telescope, musical instruments were not new, and we already had faith in them. If you sing along with the piano or lute or lyre, you automatically follow that instrument's intonation. It's a fixed reference that you trust as the bearer of truth. But there's a glitch. The real arbiter of truth lies within. There's no explaining why, but whatever the reason, we perceive a fifth to be in its most perfect and beautiful state when it's exactly 1.5 times the frequency of the note below it. We still recognize a fifth as a fifth when there are slight deviances from the perfect state. We also feel an impure fifth to be less satisfying. At a certain point, the deviation becomes more and more uncomfortable until it goes far enough away to be recognized as a different note. Our perceptions were, and still are, what determines a note's position and its structural function in any segment of music. But the most important thing is each note's quality. Each of us judges this quality according to an innate standard, which is only expressed in number after tens of thousands of years of meditating on practical experience with both intuitive and intellective mind. Before equal temperament, instruments offered a mix of perfect and imperfect intervals. There's no such arrangement of notes into a mode or scale where every interval is perfect. It's not a bad thing, because the blend of perfect and imperfect exercises our qualitative judgment and helps us to appreciate perfection all the more when we attain it. Striving toward perfection is what compels musicians to practice for hours on end, and for the rest of us to pay higher ticket prices for performances drawing closer to perfection. I doubt Vinnie realized it at the time, but by championing equal temperament, what he removed from the experience of music was the affirming love of the outer ear, sensing the perfect intervals which the inner ear desires to hear. Equal temperament has a lot of other things going for it, which is why it was eventually able to dominate world music. Vincenzo's vision for equal temperament was for the operas and orchestras that followed his times. Rock, hip-hop, and atonal music could not have been on his radar. But with hindsight that takes the loss of experiencing perfect intervals into account, these trends seem to be inevitable. Not that any of these are bad, just that they don't exercise the subtle qualitative experience of perfect intervals that first drew music out from primitive impulses. Impulses that initially fed visceral hungers and then matured into the types of qualitative assessments that an evolving mind and soul would find intellectually satisfying and emotionally fulfilling at the same time. Once instruments obscured the potential to experience the zenithal state of perfection, popular musics from the Baroque era through today trended toward returning to the primal soup from which music emerged. It's not an entirely soupy return, however, because of the persistence of language, but that's getting us away from considering just sound without any semantic baggage. Atonality is almost an opposite category from popular musics because it is coldly intellectual. By cold intellect, I mean a mind working to generate structure, form, and direction from what the senses are conveying, either because they're not intuitively obvious, or frankly, because they're not there to begin with. That's probably why atonality is a minor footnote preceding a return to tonal music, which is what we innately feel to be, well, music. But this isn't a conference on music theory or history. It's a spiritual retreat where we're trying to come closer to the triune God, or to Allah, or Brahman, or Tao, or Buddha nature, or whatever other perspective you might hold, so long as it's centered on love. That's really the bottom line in all my babbling on about perfect intervals. We love the sound of them. We love the resolution of a fifth to its root, the reciting tone to its final tone, a wavering voice to its drone. And how do we sense our closeness to whatever brand of the eternal we hold? Through a reciprocating bond of love. The closer we come to perfecting the tenets of our beliefs through meditations, actions, and the intent behind those meditations and actions, the stronger our bond of affirming love with the eternal amongst our neighbors and with our inner selves of mind, soul, and spirit, which is the seat of our personal self-judgment. What's supported by archaeological and anthropological evidence is a concurrent rise of music and belief in some sort of existence above human nature, accompanied by ritual. I don't think I'm going very far out on a limb to say that primitive humans also associated this otherness with luminescences and movements in the night sky, even though there is no physical evidence. All I've been trying to point out is that music, astronomy, and an eternal other were linked in evolving humanity long before the abilities to talk or abstractly think about them developed. If you try to imagine a world without abstract thought, which is a world without language or other symbols, what remains are not just animal impulses, feelings, and desires related to the immediate physical world, but also heightened impulses, feelings, and desires for something beyond physicality. The very fact that you're here at this retreat shows that you share the same inclinations toward the mysterious that pulled our primitive ancestors along the paths that the mysteries were laying out ahead of them. The purpose of this retreat is not to teach something new, but to instill a remembrance of something very, very old. Even with all our knowledge of astronomy, we can still look up at the moon with a sense of wonder, awe, and beauty, of being infinitesimal yet grand, of being removed and yet intimately connected. And musically, one may have been awed by the greatness of symphonies, and still be struck and transported to otherworldliness by a simple line of chant. Yet those same exact written notes of chants will bore us if sung without intent, or even make us cringe if sung with poor intonation and sloppy rhythm. The transcendent experience of a single line of chant cutting through to the inner person, or a complex form overawing the inner person, can easily be likened to religious experience. We feel closer to the eternal when we empty ourselves of all but simple yearning and wonder. Complex thought needs to be balanced with raw passion if we are to have any hope of successfully intuiting our way along the true path we find in our sacred writings and traditions. This is the path affirmed by inner pangs of love for what we inwardly hold to be true and inwardly perceive to be beautiful, whether we're considering the visual, the audible, or the beyond. Galileo used an instrument which extended our visual sense to bring us a new perspective in line with our perceptive capacities. It may have been a new perspective, but you still find the same dynamic of truth and beauty affirmed by love. Vincenzo's use of instruments, on the other hand, was to impose measures of musical intervals which we viscerally and intellectually knew were not the true measures representing their most beautiful state. They're close enough to work as a musical system, but we don't feel as strong a love for tempered intervals as we do for perfect intervals. This is Galilee versus Galilee. The Father saying that what we perceive and hold to be true can be overridden by what we can theorize to be true and can make a reality by engineering instruments in support of the theory. The Son was saying the opposite, that instruments bringing finer resolution to our senses can lead to deeper truths when they extend to our known and trusted perceptions, with the added caveat of being supported by rational abstractions. Galileo conveyed a sense that we can believe what we see through the telescope because what we perceive at a higher resolution is analogous to what we perceive with the naked eye. That's all well and good, but the intervals we hear from an equal tempered instrument are not perceived as high resolution intervals that are somehow more perfect than perfect. We perceive them as having a lesser quality. Having to accept the lesser quality is probably why it took over 100 years from Vincenzo's time for equal temperament to become the accepted standard in the West. But we're still not completely sold, because there are lots of people out there working with alternate tunings that blend perfect and imperfect intervals. So, let's try to wrap this up. While Galileo continued to place trust in visual perceptions, not directly, but through the abstractions of instrumental measurements, Vincenzo used instrumental measurements to undermine what we perceived and still perceive to be perfect and pure. Gal and Vin were at odds in their use of instruments with regard to perception, yet they were of one mind in shifting the arbiter of truth and beauty from the inner self to the external measurements of instruments. The disconnection of intuitive truth and innately perceived beauty from reason truth and indoctrinated beauty created a dissonance between the inner intuitions and perceptions of soul and the outer rationalizing and institutionalizations of intellective mind. At that point, people had to start asking themselves, which do I love and trust more? What the soul feels or the mind tells me? What the eternal gave me to perceive directly, or the extended and inevitably distorted perceptions brought to me by human invention? The Galileans from Italy introduced disharmony between the immediately sensate and the intermediaries of instruments. This effectively ended the worldview of the harmony of the spheres of music and astronomy, and where these two Galileans were at odds with the man from Galilee. Jesus turned us away from the externals of the law toward the internals of heart, mind, and soul. He didn't abolish the law or diminish its worth as an instrument against which to distinguish just any old yearnings of the inner self from the yearnings leading oneself into the folds of the eternal. Being in the fold is not to be one in God, but one in the love of the Holy Spirit. When Jesus said to love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength, and your neighbor as yourself, he implied three spheres. One, encompassing oneself and God. The second, of oneself and one's neighbors, which embraces not just the folks next door, but all of creation. And a third sphere, of a person's spiritual nature, comprised of one's inner and eternal self, of heart, mind, soul, and will. The spheres Jesus mentions are entirely intimate when viewed from the perspective of our own inner person. When our inner person steps aside to view the spheres as if disjointed from itself, however, one's inner spheres can be perceived as transcendent qualitative points, differing but little from the luminous points in sky and in sound that humans had been musing over for tens of thousands of years before Jesus was even born. Transcendent points, like luminous points, give us something immediate to focus on, sort of like the unluminous trees right in front of us and continuing to way over yonder. What Jesus invites us to consider lies beyond the personal. We're to consider the harmony of the transcendent points, not the points themselves. He wants us to see the forest, not the trees. His worldview is of the harmony of the spheres encompassing self and God, self and neighbor, and self of one's own heart, soul, mind, and spirit. These are the three spheres which ultimately comprise one's person, and which we try to bring into perfect harmony. Achieving perfect harmony in every aspect of our interactions with everyone and everything in everyday life is unfathomably complex, and probably only possible if you were a fully divine and fully human child of God. The possibility of achieving perfect harmony in the microcosm of a single melodic line of music, on the other hand, is something we can much more easily grasp via personal experience. The key phrase being via personal experience. Listening to a melody is one thing. Actually singing it is something else. Striving to sing a melody with impeccable intonation and steadfast rhythm is nothing less than striving to be perfect with no other reward than the contented warmth we feel in body, and dare I say, the love we feel for the beauty that lingers in acoustic space as it pervades one's inner self of heart, soul, and mind. When Augustine wrote about music's ability to instinct feelings of devotion in weaker minds, he could not have been considering the semantics of any texts set to music. That would be for stronger minds. He only wrote about the appeal of music's sonic beauty holding one's attention while opening one's heart to further contemplation. I chose to start this retreat by placing us in the Reformation era, because it was a time of radical change. Given our environmental and political situations, I don't think anyone will disagree that for life as we know it to continue into the future, let alone for any religious or spiritual tradition to continue, all of civilization once again needs a radical change. In my vision for the future, rather than do something new, humanity needs to go back to its roots and renew what it once had. The concept and reality of pure and perfect intervals is not new, just forgotten. It's not my intention that anyone leave this retreat with the desire to drop everything and suddenly study music to become a musician. If you haven't caught the bug by now, it probably was not in your path to begin with. What I actually hope, though, is that through the talks and practical exercises in the remainder of this retreat, those of you involved in parish ministry and/or education may be inspired to consider how a music oriented towards perfect harmony could be brought to the uninitiated as well as harnessed to revive and sustain the faithful. The ascent of tempered intervals, concurrent with Book Learning's crusade against the School of Hard Knocks, preceded a radical decline in spiritual inclination, or even more simply, the inclination to just do what we inwardly know to be right. The change in worldview and its ramifications didn't come to the fore overnight. It took hundreds of years and tens of generations. We can't just hope and pray that God will miraculously reverse the childish me-centered ideologies that humanity has been actively engaged with for the past few centuries. Not as long as we have free will and the ability to act. But if there's something worth considering in what I've been saying about striving toward the perfect harmony of truth and beauty as affirmed by love in and amongst every sphere of our lives, then there is a path that we can actively explore through a revival of the arts. What we just need to do is exercise the freedom of our will to give it a chance. Then, if it feels right and makes sense, we can hope and pray that regaining the lost spiritual orientation of harmony with the eternal takes less time than it took to lose it.